Healthy, robust men live and labor in a marvelous artificial world, he wrote. No sight of misery disturbs us, nor of despairing poverty out in vain search for employment. We work our 8 hours a day in peaceful security and in absolute confidence of our pay. But now, even the fair was laying off men, and the timing was awful. With the advent of winter, the traditional building season had come to an end. Competition for the few jobs available had intensified as thousands of unemployed men from around the country, unhappily bearing the label hobo, derived possibly from the railroad cry, "Ho, boy," converged on Chicago in hopes of getting exposition work. The dismissed men, Burnham knew, faced homelessness and poverty. Their families confronted the real prospect of starvation. But the fair came first. The absence of an Eiffel Challenger continued to frustrate Burnham. Proposals got more and more bizarre. One visionary put forth a tower 500 feet taller than the Eiffel Tower, but made entirely of logs, with a cabin at the top for shelter and refreshment. The cabin was to be a log cabin. If an engineer capable of besting Eiffel did not step forward soon, Burnham knew, there simply would not be enough time left to build anything worthy of the fair. Somehow he needed to rouse the engineers of America. The opportunity came with an invitation to give a talk to the Saturday Afternoon Club, a group of engineers who had begun meeting on Saturdays at a downtown restaurant to discuss the construction challenges of the fair. There was the usual meal in multiple courses, with wine, cigars, coffee, and cognac. At one table sat a 33-year-old engineer from Pittsburgh who ran a steel inspection company with branch offices in New York and Chicago, and which already possessed the exposition contract to inspect steel used in the fair's buildings. He had an angular face, black hair, black mustache, and dark eyes, the kind of looks soon to be coveted by an industry Thomas Edison was just then bringing to life. He was eminently engaging and social, and he had a keen sense of humor, his partners wrote. In all gatherings, he at once became the center of attraction, having a ready command of language and a constant fund of amusing anecdotes and experiences. Like the other members of the Saturday Afternoon Club, he expected to hear Burnham discuss the challenges of building an entire city on such a short schedule. But Burnham surprised him. After asserting that the architects of America had covered themselves with glory through their exposition designs, Burnham rebuked the nation's civil engineers for failing to rise to the same level of brilliance. The engineers, Burnham charged, had contributed little or nothing either in the way of originating novel features or of showing the possibilities of modern engineering practice in America. A tremor of displeasure rolled through the room. "Some distinctive feature is needed," Burnham continued, "something to take the relative position in the world's Columbian Exposition that was filled by the Eiffel Tower at the Paris Exposition." "But not a tower," he said. "Towers were not original. Eiffel had built a tower already. Mere bigness wasn't enough either. Something novel, original, daring, and unique must be designed and built if American engineers are to retain their prestige and standing." Some of the engineers took offense. Others acknowledged that Burnham had a point. The engineer from Pittsburgh felt himself cut to the quick by the truth of these remarks. As he sat there among his peers, an idea came to him like an inspiration. It arrived not as some half-formed impulse, he said, but rich in detail. He could see it and touch it, hear it as it moved through the sky. There was not much time left, but if he acted quickly to produce drawings and managed to convince the fair's Ways and Means Committee of the idea's feasibility, he believed the exposition could indeed out Eiffel Eiffel. And if what happened to Eiffel happened to him, his fortune would be assured. It must have been refreshing for Burnham to stand before the Saturday Afternoon Club and openly chide its members for their failure, because most of his other encounters over exposition business invariably became exercises in self-restraint, especially when he went before the fair's many and still multiplying committees. This constant Victorian minuet of false grace consumed time. He needed more power. Not for his own ego, but for the sake of the exposition. Unless the pace of decision-making accelerated, he knew, the fair would fall irreparably behind schedule. Yet, if anything, the barriers to efficiency were increasing in size and number. The exposition company's shrinking war chest had driven its relationship with the National Commission to a new low, with Director General Davis arguing that any new federal money should be controlled by his commission. The commission seemed to form new departments every day, each with a paid chief. Davis named a superintendent of sheep for a salary equivalent to $60,000 a year, and each claiming some piece of jurisdiction that Burnham thought belonged to him. Soon the struggle for control distilled to a personal conflict between Burnham and Davis, its primary battlefield a disagreement over who should control the artistic design of exhibits and interiors. Burnham thought it obvious that the territory belonged to him. Davis believed otherwise. At first, Burnham tried the oblique approach. "We are now organizing a special interior decorative and architectural force to handle this part," he wrote to Davis, "and I have the honor to offer the services of my department to yours in such manners. I feel a delicacy in having my men suggest to yours artistic arrangements, forms, and decorations of exhibits without your full approval, which I hereby respectfully ask." But Davis told the reporter, "I think it is pretty well understood by this time that no one but the Director General and his agents have anything to do with exhibits." The conflict simmered. On March 14th, Burnham joined Davis for dinner with Japan's delegate to the fair at the Chicago Club. Afterward, Davis and Burnham remained at the club, arguing quietly until 5 o'clock the next morning. "The time was well spent," he wrote to Margaret, who was then out of town, "and we have come to a better feeling so that the path will be much smoother from this time forward." An uncharacteristic weariness crept into his letter. He told Margaret he planned to end work early that night and go to Evanston. "And sleep in your dear bed, my love, and I shall dream of you. What a rush this life is! Where do the years go to?" There were moments of grace. Burnham looked forward to evenings on the grounds when his lieutenants and visiting architects would gather for dinner at the shanty and converse into the night in front of Burnham's immense fireplace. Burnham treasured the camaraderie and the stories. Olmsted recounted the endless trials of protecting Central Park from ill-thought modifications. Colonel Edmund Rice, chief of the exposition's Columbian Guard, described what it was like to stand in a shaded wood at Gettysburg as Pickett launched his men across the intervening field. Late in March 1892, Burnham invited his sons to join him at the shanty for one of their periodic overnight stays. They failed to arrive at the scheduled time. At first, everyone attributed their absence to a routine railroad delay, but as the hours passed, Burnham's anxiety grew. He knew as well as anyone that train wrecks in Chicago were nearly a daily occurrence. Darkness began to fall, but at last the boys arrived. Their train had been held up by a broken bridge on the Milwaukee and St. Paul line. They reached the shanty, Burnham wrote to Margaret, just in time to hear Colonel Rice tell some yarns about the war and life in the plains among the scouts and Indians. As Burnham wrote this letter, his sons were near at hand. "They are very happy to be here and are now looking at the large photographic album with Mr. Geraldine." The album was a collection of construction photographs taken by Charles Dudley Arnold, a photographer from Buffalo, New York, whom Burnham had hired as the fair's official photographer. Arnold also was present, and soon the children were to join him in a sketching session. Burnham closed, "We are all well and satisfied with the amount and variety of work our good fortune has given us to do." Such peaceful intervals never lasted long. The conflict between Burnham and Davis again flared to life. The directors of the Exposition Company did decide to seek a direct appropriation from Congress, but their request triggered a congressional investigation of the fair's expenditures. Burnham and President Baker expected a general review, but instead found themselves grilled about the most mundane expenses. For example, when Baker listed the total spent on carriage rental, the subcommittee demanded the names of the people who rode in the carriages. At one session in Chicago, the committee asked Davis to estimate the final cost of the exposition. Without consulting Burnham, Davis gave an estimate 10% below the amount Burnham had calculated for President Baker, which Baker had then included in his own statement to investigators. Davis's testimony carried with it the unstated accusation that Burnham and Baker had inflated the amount of money needed to complete the fair. Burnham leapt to his feet. The subcommittee chairman ordered him to sit. He remained standing. He was angry, barely able to keep himself composed. "Mr. Davis has not been to see me or any of my people," he said, "and any figures he has given, he has jumped at. He knows nothing about the matter." His outburst offended the subcommittee chairman. "I object to any such remarks addressed to a witness before this committee," the chairman said, "and I will ask that Mr. Burnham withdraw his remark." At first, Burnham refused. Then, reluctantly, he agreed to withdraw the part about Davis knowing nothing. But only that part. He did not apologize. The committee left for Washington to study the evidence and report on whether an appropriation was warranted. "The congressmen," Burnham wrote, "are dazed with the size and scope of this enterprise. We gave them each a huge pile of data to digest, and I think their report will be funny, because I know that months would not be enough time for me to work out a report, even with my knowledge." On paper, at least, the fair's midway placings began to take shape. Professor Putnam had believed the midway ought first and foremost to provide an education about alien cultures. Saul Bloom felt no such duty. The midway was to be fun, a great pleasure garden stretching for more than a mile from Jackson Park all the way to the border of Washington Park. It would thrill, titillate, and, if all went well, perhaps even shock. He considered his great strength to be spectacular advertising. He placed notices in publications around the world to make it known that the midway was to be an exotic realm of unusual sights, sounds, and scents. There would be authentic villages from far-off lands inhabited by authentic villagers. Even pygmies, if Lieutenant Shufeld succeeded. Bloom recognized also that as Tsar of the Midway, he no longer had to worry about seeking a concession for his Algerian village. He could approve the village himself. He produced a contract and sent it off to Paris. Bloom's knack for promotion caught the attention of other fair officials, who came to him for help in raising the exposition's overall profile. At one point, he was called upon to help make reporters understand how truly immense the manufacturer's building would be. So far, the exposition's publicity office had given the press a detailed list of monumental but dreary statistics. "I could tell they weren't in the least interested in the number of acres or tons of steel," Bloom wrote. "So I said, look at it this way. It's going to be big enough to hold the entire standing army of Russia." Bloom had no idea whether Russia even had a standing army, let alone how many soldiers it might include and how many square feet they would cover. Nonetheless, the fact became gospel throughout America. Readers of Rand McNally's exposition guidebooks eventually found themselves thrilling to the vision of millions of fur-hatted men squeezed onto the building's 32-acre floor. Bloom felt no remorse. The Angel from Dwight. In the spring of 1892, Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pititzel, found himself in the city of Dwight, Illinois, about 75 miles southwest of Chicago, taking the famous Keeley cure for alcoholism. Patients stayed in the three-story Livingston Hotel, a red brick building of simple, appealing design, with arched windows and a veranda along the full length of its facade, a fine place to rest between injections of Dr. Leslie Enrot Keeley's Gold Cure. Gold was the most famous ingredient in a red, white, and blue solution nicknamed the barber pole that employees of the Keeley Institute injected into patients' arms three times a day. The needle, one of large 19th-century bore, like having a garden hose shoved into a bicep, invariably deposited a yellow aureole on the skin surrounding the injection site, a badge for some, an unsightly blemish for others. The rest of the formula was kept secret, but as best doctors and chemists could tell, the solution included substances that imparted a pleasant state of euphoria and sedation, trimmed with amnesia. An effect the Chicago Post Office found problematic, for each year it wound up holding hundreds of letters sent from Dwight that lacked important elements of their destination addresses. The senders simply forgot that things like names and street numbers were necessary for the successful delivery of mail. Pititzel had long been a heavy drinker, but his drinking must have become debilitating, for it was Holmes who sent him to Keeley and paid for his treatment. He explained it to Pititzel as a gesture born of kindness, a return for Pititzel's loyalty. As always, he had other motives. He recognized that Pititzel's drinking impaired his usefulness and threatened to disrupt schemes already in play. Holmes later said of Pititzel, "He was too valuable a man, even with his failings taken into consideration, for me to dispense with." It's likely Holmes also wanted Pititzel to gather whatever intelligence he could about the cure and its labeling, so that he could mimic the product and sell it through his own mail-order drug company. Later, indeed, Holmes would establish his own curative spa on the second floor of his Englewood building and call it the Silver Ash Institute. The Keeley cure was amazingly popular. Thousands of people came to Dwight to shed their intemperate ways. Many thousands more bought Dr. Keeley's oral version of the cure, which he marketed in bottles so distinctive that he urged purchasers to destroy the empties, to keep unscrupulous companies from filling them with their own concoctions. Every day Pititzel joined 36 other men in the daily ritual of passing through the line to receive his injections. Women received theirs in their own rooms and were kept separated from the men to protect their reputations. In Chicago, hostesses always knew when guests had taken the cure, because upon being offered a drink, the guests invariably answered, "No, thank you. I've been to Dwight." Pititzel returned to Englewood in April. The psychotropic powers of Keeley's injections may account for the story Pititzel now told Holmes, of how at Keeley he had met a young woman of great beauty. To hear him tell it, preternatural beauty, named Emmeline Sigrund. She was blonde, 24 years old, and since 1891 had worked as a stenographer in Dr. Keeley's office. Pititzel's almost hallucinatory description must have tantalized Holmes, for he wrote to Sigrund and offered her a job as his personal secretary at twice the salary she was making in Keeley. A flattering offer, as a member of the Sigrund family later described it. Emmeline accepted without hesitation. The Institute had a certain cachet, but the village of Dwight was no Chicago. To be able to earn twice her salary and live in that city of legendary glamour and excitement, with the World's Fair set to open in a year, made the offer irresistible. She left Keeley in May, bringing along her $800 in savings. Upon arriving in Englewood, she rented rooms in a boarding house near Holmes's building. Pititzel had exaggerated Emmeline's beauty, Holmes saw, but not by much. She was indeed lovely, with luminous blonde hair. Immediately Holmes deployed his tools of seduction, his soothing voice and touch and frank blue gaze. He bought her flowers and took her to the Timmerman Opera House down the block. He gave her a bicycle. They spent evenings riding together on the smooth macadam of Yale and Harvard streets, the picture of a happy young couple blessed with looks and money. White piqué hats with black watered ribbon bands and a couple of knife feathers set at the side are the latest novelty for women cyclists, the Tribune's society column observed. As Emmeline became more accustomed to her wheel, a term everyone still used even though the old and deadly huge-wheeled bicycles of the past had become thoroughly obsolete, she and Holmes took longer and longer rides and often rode down the willowed midway to Jackson Park to watch the construction of the World's Fair, where inevitably they found themselves among thousands of other people, many of them also bicyclists. On a few Sundays, Emmeline and Holmes rode into the park itself, where they saw that construction was still in its early phase, a surprise given the rapid onset of the fair's two most important deadlines, Dedication Day and Opening Day. Much of the park was still barren land, and the biggest building, the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts, was barely underway. A few buildings had advanced at a far greater pace and appeared to be more or less complete, in particular the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. There were so many distinguished-looking men in the park these days. Statesmen, princes, architects, and the city's industrial barons. Society matrons came as well to attend meetings of the Board of Lady Managers. Mrs. Palmer's great black carriage often came roaring through the fair's gate, as did the carriage of her social opposite, Carrie Watson, the Madam, her coach distinctive for its gleaming white enamel and yellow wheels, and its black driver in scarlet silk. Emmeline found that riding her bicycle was best in the days after a good downpour. Otherwise, the dust billowed like sand over Khartoum and sifted deep into her scalp, where even a good brushing failed to dislodge it. One afternoon, as Emmeline sat before her typewriter in Holmes's office, a man entered, looking for Holmes. He was tall with a clean jaw and modest mustache, and wore a cheap suit. In his 30s. Good-looking, in a way, but at the same time self-effacing and plain, though at the moment he appeared to be angry. He introduced himself as Ned Connor and said he once had run the jewelry counter in the pharmacy downstairs. He had come to discuss a problem with a mortgage. She knew the name, had heard it somewhere or seen it in Holmes's papers. She smiled and told Ned that Holmes was out of the building. She had no idea when he would return. Could she help? Ned's anger cooled. He and Emmeline got to talking about Holmes, as Ned later recalled. Ned watched her. She was young and pretty. A handsome blonde, as he later described her. She wore a white shirtwaist and black skirt that accentuated her trim figure, and was seated beside a window, her hair candescent with sunlight. She sat before a black Remington, new and, doubtless, never paid for. From his own hard experience and from the look of adoration that entered Emmeline's eyes when she spoke of Holmes, Ned guessed her relationship involved a good deal more than typewriting. Later, he recalled, "I told her I thought he was a bad lot and that she had better have little to do with him and get away from him as soon as possible." For the time being, at least, she ignored his advice. On May 1, 1892, a doctor named M.B. Lawrence and his wife moved into a five-room apartment in Holmes's building, where they often encountered Emmeline, although Emmeline herself did not yet live in the building. She still occupied rooms in a nearby boarding house. "She was one of the prettiest and most pleasant young women I ever met," said Dr. Lawrence, "and my wife and I learned to think a great deal of her. We saw her every day, and she often came in for a few minutes' chat with Mrs. Lawrence." The Lawrences often saw Emmeline in Holmes's company. "It was not long," Dr. Lawrence said, "before I became aware that the relations between Miss Sigrand and Mr. Holmes were not strictly those of an employer and employee, but we felt that she was to be more pitied than blamed." Emmeline was infatuated with Holmes. She loved him for his warmth, his caresses, his imperturbable calm, and his glamour. Never had she met a man quite like him. He was even the son of an English lord, a fact he had confided in strictest secrecy. She was to tell no one, which dampened the fun quite a bit, but added to the mystery. She did reveal the secret to friends, of course, but only after first securing their oaths that they absolutely would tell no one else. To Emmeline, Holmes's claim of lordly heritage had credibility. The name Holmes clearly was English. To know that, all one had to do was read the immensely popular stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And an English heritage would explain his extraordinary charm and smooth manner, so unusual in brutish, clangorous Chicago. Emmeline was a warm and outgoing woman. She wrote often to her family in Lafayette, Indiana, and to the friends she had made in Dwight. She acquired friends easily. She still dined at regular intervals with the woman who ran the first boarding house in which she had stayed after her arrival in Chicago, and considered the woman an intimate friend. In October, two of her second cousins, Dr. and Mrs. B.J. Sigrend, paid her a visit. Dr. Sigrend, a dentist with an office at North and Milwaukee Avenues on Chicago's north side, had contacted Emmeline because he was working on a history of the Sigrend family. They had not previously met. "I was charmed by her pleasing manners and keen wit," Dr. Sigrend said. "She was a splendid woman physically, being tall, well-formed, and with a wealth of flaxen hair." Dr. Sigrend and his wife did not encounter Holmes on this visit, and in fact they never did meet him face to face. But they heard glowing stories from Emmeline about his charm, generosity, and business prowess. Emmeline took her cousins on a tour of Holmes's building and told them of his effort to transform it into a hotel for exposition guests. She explained, too, how the elevated railroad being erected over 63rd Street would carry guests directly to Jackson Park. No one doubted that by the summer of 1893, armies of visitors would be advancing on Englewood. To Emmeline, success seemed inevitable. Emmeline's enthusiasm was part of her charm. She was headlong in love with her young physician, and thus in love with all that he did. But Dr. Sigrend did not share her glowing assessment of the building and its prospects. To him, the building was gloomy and imposing, out of spirit with its surrounding structures. Every other building of substance in Englewood seemed to be charged with the energy of anticipation, not just of the World's Fair, but of a grand future expanding far beyond the fair's end. Within just a couple of blocks of 63rd rose huge, elaborate houses of many colors and textures, and down the street stood the Timmerman Opera House and the adjacent New Julian Hotel, whose owners clearly had spent heavily on fine materials and expert craftsmen. In contrast, Holmes's building was dead space, like the corner of a room where the gaslight could not reach. Clearly, Holmes had not consulted an architect, at least not a competent one. The building's corridors were dark and pocked with too many doors. The lumber was low grade, the carpentry slipshod. Passages veered at odd angles. Still, Emmeline seemed entranced. Dr. Sigrend would have been a cold man indeed to have dashed that sweet, naive adoration. Later, no doubt, he wished he had been more candid and had listened more closely to the whisper in his head about the wrongness of that building and the discontinuity between its true appearance and Emmeline's perception of its appearance. But again, Emmeline was in love. It was not his place to wound her. She was young and enraptured, her joy infectious, especially to Dr. Sigrend, the dentist, who saw so little joy from day to day as he reduced grown men of proven courage to tears. Soon after the Sigrend's visit, Holmes asked Emmeline to marry him, and she accepted. He promised her a honeymoon in Europe, during which, of course, they would pay a visit to his father, the Lord. Monstrosity. Olmsted's teeth hurt. His ears roared, and he could not sleep. Yet throughout the first months of 1892, he kept up a pace that would have been punishing for a man one-third his age. He traveled to Chicago, Asheville, Knoxville, Louisville, and Rochester, each overnight leg compounding his distress. In Chicago, despite the tireless efforts of his young lieutenant, Harry Codman, the work was far behind schedule, the task ahead growing more enormous by the day. The first major deadline, the dedication set for October 21st, 1892, seemed impossibly near, and would have seemed even more so had not fair officials changed the original date, October 12th, to allow New York City to hold its own Columbus celebration. Given the calumny New York previously had shoveled on Chicago, the postponement was an act of surprising grace. Construction delays elsewhere on the grounds were especially frustrating for Olmsted. When contractors fell behind, his own work fell behind. His completed work also suffered. Workmen trampled his plantings and destroyed his roads. The government building was a case in point. All over its surroundings, reported Rudolf Ulrich, his landscape superintendent, material of any kind and all descriptions was piled up and scattered in such profusion that only repeated and persistent pressure brought to bear upon the officials in charge could gain any headway in beginning the work. And even then, improvements being well underway, no regard was paid to them. What had been accomplished one day would be spoiled the next. The delays and damage angered Olmsted, but other matters distressed him even more. Unbelievably, despite Olmsted's hectoring, Burnham still seemed to consider steam-powered launches an acceptable choice for the exposition's boat service. And no one seemed to share his conviction that the wooded island must remain free of all structures. The island had come under repeated assault, prompting a resurfacing of Olmsted's old anger about the compulsion of clients to tinker with his landscapes. Everyone wanted space on the island. First, it was Theodore Thomas, conductor of Chicago's symphony, who saw the island as the ideal site, the only site, for a music hall worthy of the fair. Olmsted would not allow it. Next came Theodore Roosevelt, head of the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and a human gunboat. The island, he insisted, was perfect for the hunting camp exhibit of his Boone and Crockett Club. Not surprisingly, given Roosevelt's power in Washington, the politicians of the fair's National Commission strongly endorsed his plan. Burnham, partly to keep the peace, also urged Olmsted to accept it. "Would you object to its being placed on the north end of the island, snuggled in among the trees, purely as an exhibit, provided it shall be so concealed as to only be noticed casually by those on the island, and not at all from the shore?" Olmsted did object. He agreed to let Roosevelt place his camp on a lesser island, but would not allow any buildings, only a few tents, some horses, campfire, etc. Later, he permitted the installation of a small hunter's cabin. Next came the U.S. government, seeking to place an Indian exhibit on the island. And after this, Professor Putnam, the fair's chief of ethnology, who saw the island as the ideal site for several exotic villages. The government of Japan also wanted the island. They propose an outdoor exhibit of their temples, and, as has been usual, they desire space on the wooded island, Burnham wrote in February 1892. To Burnham it now seemed inevitable that something would occupy the island. The setting was just too appealing. Burnham urged Olmsted to accept Japan's proposal. "It seems beyond any question to be the thing fitting to the locality, and I cannot see that it will in any manner detract essentially from the features which you care for. They propose to do the most exquisitely beautiful things, and desire to leave the buildings as a gift to the city of Chicago after the close of the fair." Fearing much worse, Olmsted agreed. It did not help his mood any that as he battled to protect the island, he learned of another attack on his beloved Central Park. At the instigation of a small group of wealthy New Yorkers, the state legislature had quietly passed a law authorizing the construction of a speedway on the west side of the park so that the rich could race their carriages. The public responded with outrage. Olmsted weighed in with a letter describing the proposed road as unreasonable, unjust, and immoral. The legislature backed off. His insomnia and pain, the crushing workload, his mounting frustration, all tore at his spirit until by the end of March, he felt himself on the verge of physical and emotional collapse. The intermittent depression that had shadowed him throughout his adult life was about to envelop him once again. "When Olmsted is blue," a friend once wrote, "the logic of his despondency is crushing and terrible." Olmsted, however, believed all he needed was a good rest. In keeping with the therapeutic mores of the age, he decided to do his convalescing in Europe, where the scenery also would provide an opportunity to enrich his visual vocabulary. He planned forays to public gardens and parks and the grounds of the old Paris Exposition. He put his eldest son, John, in charge of the Brookline office and left Harry Codman in Chicago to guide the work on the World's Fair. At the last minute, he decided to bring along two of his children, Marion and Rick, and another young man, Phil Codman, who was Harry's younger brother. For Marion and the boys, it promised to be a dream journey. For Olmsted, it became something rather more dark. They sailed on Saturday, April 2nd, 1892, and arrived in Liverpool under a barrage of hail and snow. In Chicago, Saul Bloom received a cable from France that startled him. He read it a couple of times to make sure it said what he thought it said. His Algerians, scores of them, along with all their animals and material possessions, were already at sea, sailing for America and the fair, 1 year early. They had picked the right month, Bloom said, but the wrong year. Olmsted found the English countryside charming, the weather bleak and morbid. After a brief stay at the home of relatives in Chislehurst, he and the boys left for Paris. Daughter Marion stayed behind. In Paris, Olmsted went to the old exposition grounds. The gardens were sparse, suppressed by a long winter, and the buildings had not weathered well, but enough of the fair remained to give him a tolerable idea of what the exposition once had been. Clearly the site was still popular. During one Sunday visit, Olmsted and the boys found four bands playing, refreshment stands open, and a few thousand people roaming the paths. A long line had formed at the base of the Eiffel Tower. With the Chicago Fair always in mind, Olmsted examined every detail. The lawns were rather poor, the gravel walks not pleasant to the eye nor to the foot. He found the Paris Fair's extensive use of formal flower beds objectionable. "It seemed to me," he wrote in a letter to John in Brookline, "that at the least it must have been extremely disquieting, gaudy and childish, if not savage and an injury to the exposition, through its disturbance of dignity and injury to breadth, unity, and composure." He reiterated his insistence that in Chicago, simplicity and reserve will be practiced and petty effects and frippery avoided. The visit rekindled his concern that in the quest to surpass the Paris Exposition, Burnham and his architects had lost sight of what a World's Fair ought to be. "The Paris buildings," Olmsted wrote, "have much more color and much more ornament in color, but much less in molding and sculpture than I had supposed. They show, I think, more fitness for their purposes, seem more designed for the occasion, and to be less like grand permanent architectural monuments than ours are to be. I question if ours are not at fault in this respect, and if they are not going to look too assuming of architectural stateliness and to be overbonded with sculptural and other efforts for grandeur and grandiloquent pomp. Olmsted liked traveling with his youthful entourage. In a letter to his wife in Brookline, he wrote, "I am having a great deal of enjoyment, and I hope laying in a good stock of better health." Soon after the party returned to Chislehurst, however, Olmsted's health degraded, and insomnia again shattered his nights. He wrote to Harry Codman, who was himself ill with a strange abdominal illness, "I can only conclude now that I am older and more used up than I had supposed." A doctor, Henry Rayner, paid a social visit to Chislehurst to meet Olmsted. He happened to be a specialist in treating nervous disorders, and was so appalled by Olmsted's appearance that he offered to take him to his own house in Hampstead Heath outside London and care for him personally. Olmsted accepted. Despite Rayner's close attention, Olmsted's condition did not improve. His stay at Hampstead Heath became wearisome. "You know that I am practically in prison here," he wrote to Harry Codman on June 16, 1892. "Every day I look for decided improvement, and thus far every day I am disappointed." Dr. Rayner, too, was perplexed, according to Olmsted. He says, with confidence, "After repeated examinations of all my anatomy, that I have no organic trouble, and that I may reasonably expect, under favorable circumstances, to keep at work for several years to come. He regards my present trouble as a variation in form of the troubles which led me to come abroad." Most days Olmsted was driven by carriage through the countryside, every day more or less on a different road, to view gardens, churchyards, private parks, and the natural landscape. Nearly every ornamental flowerbed offended him. He dismissed them as childish, vulgar, flaunting, or impertinent, out of place and discordant. The countryside itself, however, charmed him. "There is nothing in America to be compared with the pastoral or with the picturesque beauty that is common property in England. I cannot go out without being delighted. The view before me as I write, veiled by the rain, is just enchanting." The loveliest scenes, he found, were comprised of the simplest, most natural juxtapositions of native plants. "The finest combination is one of gorse, sweetbriar, brambles, hawthorn, and ivy. Even when there is no bloom, this is charming. And these things can be had by the 100,000 at very low prices." At times, the scenes he saw challenged his vision of Jackson Park. At other times, they affirmed it. "Everywhere the best ornamental grounds that we see are those in which vines and creepers are outwitting the gardener. We can't have little vines and weeds enough." He knew there was too little time to let nature alone produce such effects. "Let us, as much as possible, train out creepers and branches of trees upon bridges, pulling down and nailing the branches, aiming to obtain shade and reflection of foliage and broken obscuration of water." Above all, his sorties reinforced his belief that the wooded island, despite the Japanese temple, should be made as wild as possible. "I think more than ever of the value of the island," he wrote to Harry Codman, "and of the importance of using all possible original means of securing impervious screening, dense, massive piles of foliage on its borders, with abundant variety of small detail in abject subordination to general effect. There cannot be enough of bulrush, adlumia, Madeira vine, catbriar, virgin's bower, brambles, sweet peas, jimson weed, milkweed, the smaller western sunflowers, and morning glories." But he also recognized that the wildness he sought would have to be tempered with excellent groundskeeping. He worried that Chicago would not be up to the task. "The standard of an English laborer, hack driver, or cad in respect to neatness, smugness, and elegance of gardens and grounds and paths and ways is infinitely higher than that of a Chicago merchant prince or virtuoso," he wrote to Codman. and we shall be disgraced if we fail to work up to a far higher level than our masters will be prepared to think suitable." Overall, Olmsted remained confident that his exposition landscape would succeed. A new worry troubled him, however. "The only cloud I see over the exposition now is the cholera," he wrote in a letter to his Brookline office. "The accounts from Russia and from Paris this morning are alarming." As Saul Bloom's Algerians neared New York Harbor, workers assigned to the Midway erected temporary buildings to house them. Bloom went to New York to meet the ship and reserved 2 train cars to bring the villagers and their cargo back to Chicago. As the Algerians left the ship, they began moving in all directions at once. "I could see them getting lost, being run over, and landing in jail," Bloom said. "No one seemed to be in charge." Bloom raced up to them, shouting commands in French and English. A giant black-complected man walked up to Bloom and, in perfect House of Lords English, said, "I suggest you be more civil. Otherwise I may lose my temper and throw you into the water." The man identified himself as Archie, and as the two settled into a more peaceful conversation, he revealed to Bloom that he had spent a decade in London serving as a rich man's bodyguard. "At present," he said, "I am responsible for conveying my associates to a place called Chicago. I understand it is somewhere in the hinterland." Bloom handed him a cigar and proposed that he become his bodyguard and assistant. "Your offer," Archie said, "is quite satisfactory." Both men lit up and puffed smoke into the fragrant murk above New York Harbor. Bloom wanted to thrill America, but even he did not appreciate the power the Algerians possessed to succeed at the task. Bloom put the members to work. Archie became a powerful and vaguely threatening presence in his office. Several Algerian women also worked there, clad in customary dress and speaking excellent English, while evoking a world of cinnamon and heat that greatly enhanced Bloom's stature as a promotional prodigy. Burnham fought to boost the rate of construction, especially of the manufacturer's building, which had to be completed by dedication day. In March, with just half a year remaining until the dedication, he invoked the Tsar clause of his construction contracts. He ordered the builder of the electricity building to double his workforce and to put the men to work at night under electric lights. He threatened the manufacturer's contractor with the same fate if he did not increase the pace of his work. Burnham had all but given up hope of surpassing the Eiffel Tower. Most recently, he had turned down another outlandish idea, this from an earnest young Pittsburgh engineer who had attended his lecture to the Saturday Afternoon Club. The man was credible enough. His company held the contract for inspecting all the steel used in the fair's structures, but the thing he proposed to build just did not seem feasible. "Too fragile," Burnham told him. "The public," he said, "would be afraid." A hostile spring further hampered the fair's progress. On Tuesday, April 5th, 1892, at 6:50 a.m., a sudden windstorm demolished the fair's just-finished pumping station and tore down 65 feet of the Illinois State Building. 3 weeks later, another storm destroyed 800 feet of the south wall of the manufacturer's building. "The wind," the Tribune observed, "seems to have a grudge against the World's Fair grounds." To find ways to accelerate the work, Burnham called the Eastern Architects to Chicago. One looming problem was how to color the exteriors of the main buildings, especially the staff-coated palisades of the manufacturer's building. During the meeting, an idea arose that promised a dramatic acceleration of the work. No one could have foretold how this one decision would forever fix the fair in the world's imagination as a thing of otherworldly beauty. By all rights, the arena of exterior decoration belonged to William Prettyman, the fair's official director of color. Burnham admitted later that he had hired Prettyman for the job largely on account of his great friendship for John Root. Prettyman was ill-suited to the job. Harriet Monrose, who knew him and his wife, wrote, "His genius was betrayed by lofty and indomitable traits of character which could not yield or compromise, and so his life was a tragedy of inconsequence." The day of the meeting, Prettyman was on the East Coast. The architects proceeded without him. "I was urging everyone on, knowing I had an awful fight against time," Burnham said. "We talked about the colors, and finally the thought came, let us make it all perfectly white." I do not remember who made that suggestion. It might have been one of those things that reached all minds at once. At any rate, I decided it. The Mines Building, designed by Chicago's Solon S. Beeman, was nearly finished. It became the test building. Burnham ordered it painted a creamy white. Prettyman returned and was outraged, Burnham recalled. Prettyman insisted that any decision on color was his alone. "I don't see it that way," Burnham told him. "The decision is mine." "All right," Prettyman said. "I will get out." Burnham did not miss him. He was a brooding sort of man and very cranky, Burnham said. "I let him go, then told Charles McKim that I would have to have a man who could actually take charge of it, and that I would not decide from the point of friendship." McKim recommended the New York painter Francis Millet, who had sat in on the color meeting. A brief period of awkwardness followed over the question of salary. Millet would be delighted to join the fair, a memorandum reported, but regretted extremely that circumstances were such that he must, in a measure, consider the question of compensation. Over dinner in New York at Delmonico's, Burnham agreed to a salary of $15,000, the highest paid to any fair official other than himself. In July, the executive committee formally approved Millet's appointment, but for only half the salary Burnham had offered. By then, however, Millet had fallen for the fair and for Burnham, and would have stayed even if the committee had cut his salary to nothing. Millet quickly proved his worth. After some experimentation, he settled on ordinary white lead and oil as the best paint for staff, then developed a means of applying the paint not by brush, but through a hose with a special nozzle fashioned from a length of gas pipe. The first spray paint. Burnham nicknamed Millet and his paint crews the Whitewash Gang. In the first week of May, a powerful storm dropped an ocean of rain on Chicago and again caused the Chicago River to reverse flow. With its baggage of dead animals and human sewage, the river raced into Lake Michigan with such force that tugboats towing steamships had to wait at the river's mouth until the flow subsided. Again, the sewage threatened the city's water supply. The decaying carcass of a horse was spotted bobbing near one of the intake cribs. This new surge underscored for Burnham the urgency of completing his plan to pipe Waukesha spring water to the fair by opening day. Earlier in July 1891, the exposition had granted a contract for the work to the Hygieia Mineral Springs Company, headed by an entrepreneur named J. E. McElroy. But the company had accomplished little. In March, Burnham ordered Dion Geraldine, his chief construction superintendent, to press the matter with the utmost vigor and see that no delay occurs. Hygieia secured rights to lay its pipe from its springhouse in Waukesha through the village itself, but failed to anticipate the intensity of opposition from citizens who feared the pipeline would disfigure their landscape and drain their famous springs. Hygieia's McElroy, under mounting pressure from Burnham, turned to desperate measures. On Saturday evening, May 7th, 1892, McElroy loaded a special train with pipes, picks, shovels, and 300 men and set off for Waukesha to dig his pipeline under cover of darkness. Word of the expedition beat the train to Waukesha. As it pulled into the station, someone rang the village fire bell, and soon a large force of men armed with clubs, pistols, and shotguns converged on the train. Two fire engines arrived, hissing steam, their crews ready to blast the pipe layers with water. One village leader told McElroy that if he went ahead with his plan, he would not leave town alive. Soon, another 1,000 or so townspeople joined the small army at the station. One group of men dragged a cannon from town hall and trained it on Hygieia's bottling plant. After a brief standoff, McElroy and the pipelayers went back to Chicago. Burnham still wanted that water. Workers already had laid pipes in Jackson Park for 200 spring water booths. McElroy gave up trying to run pipes directly into the village of Waukesha. Instead, he bought a spring in the town of Big Bend, 12 miles south of Waukesha, just inside the Waukesha County line. Fair visitors would be able to drink Waukesha spring water after all. That the water came from the county and not the famous village was a subtlety upon which Burnham and McElroy did not dwell. In Jackson Park, everyone became caught up in the accelerating pace of construction. As the buildings rose, the architects spotted flaws in their designs, but found the forward crush of work so overwhelming it threatened to leave the flaws locked in stone, or at least staff. Frank Millett unofficially kept watch over the buildings of the Eastern architects during their lengthy absences from the park, lest some ad hoc decision cause irreparable aesthetic damage. On June 6, 1892, he wrote to Charles McKim, designer of the agriculture building, "You had better write a letter embodying all the ideas of changes you have, because before you know it, they'll have you by the umbilicus. I staved them off from a cement floor in the rotunda today and insisted that you must have brick. It takes no end of time and worry to get a thing settled right, but only a second to have orders given out for a wrong thing to be done. All these remarks are in strict confidence, and I write in this way to urge you to be explicit and flat-footed in your wishes." At the manufacturer's building, workers employed by contractor Francis Agnew began the dangerous process of raising the giant iron trusses that would support the building's roof and create the widest span of unobstructed interior space ever attempted. The workers installed three sets of parallel railroad tracks along the length of the building. Atop these, on rail car wheels or trucks, they erected a traveler, a giant derrick comprised of three tall towers spanned at the top by a platform. Workers using the traveler could lift and position two trusses at a time. Henry Post's design called for 22 trusses, each weighing 200 tons. Just getting the components to the park had required 600 rail cars. On Wednesday, June 1st, exposition photographer Charles Arnold took a photograph of the building to record its progress. Anyone looking at that photograph would have to conclude that the building could not possibly be finished in the 4.5 months that remained until dedication day. The trusses were in place, but no roof. The walls were just beginning to rise. When Arnold took the photograph, hundreds of men were at work on the building, but its scale was so great that none of the men was immediately visible. The ladders that rose from one level of scaffold to the next had all the substance of matchsticks and imparted to the structure an aura of fragility. In the foreground stood mountains of debris. 2 weeks later, Arnold returned for another photograph and captured a very different scene. One of devastation. On the night of June 13th, just after 9 o'clock, another abrupt storm struck the fairgrounds, and this one also seemed to single out the manufacturer's building. A large portion of the building's north end collapsed, and in turn caused the failure of an elevated gallery designed to ring the interior of the building. 100,000 feet of lumber crashed to the floor. Arnold's photograph of the aftermath showed a Lilliputian man, possibly Burnham, standing before a great mound of shattered wood and tangled steel. This, of all buildings. The contractor, Francis Agnew, acknowledged the wall had been inadequately braced, but blamed this condition on Burnham for pushing the men to build too quickly. Now Burnham pushed them even harder,